Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 2nd, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing today, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Very well. Very well. Well, D.R., the Earth passed officially and finally a depressing milestone this month. Tell me, I'll let you, since it depresses me too much, I'll let you announce the bad news. What happened?
Well, according to Climate Central, that in September, the planet finally permanently hit above the 400 parts per million mark in terms of CO2 in the atmosphere, and it is highly unlikely that it will drop in our collective lifetimes, according to climate scientists. This is a 42% increase from pre-industrial levels, according to Think Progress. And, you know, for all the talk about, you know, trying to get to 350, that seems to be dreaming an impossible dream at this point.
Right. I mean, everyone knows Bill McKibben, and they all know his organization is 350.org. And the 350 comes from the recognition and the assertion of the scientific assertion that the maximum amount of CO2 in the atmosphere that's safe to keep the planet reasonably intact is 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. And as you just said, we finally have crossed ultimately the 400 ppm mark. I mean, just as sort of a geeky side detail, people should know that the 400 ppm mark has been crossed probably a year ago now that we finally did it. But if you've never seen the Keeling curve, right? So the Keeling curve is this thing from Hawaii that shows the carbon dioxide steadily rising. If you look closely at that, you see a little wiggle on top of the generally rising curve. There's a little wiggle, and that little wiggle represents the change in the annual change in the carbon dioxide. That's for the following reason. In the northern hemisphere, in the summertime, all of the trees blossom and the leaves suck up a lot of CO2. Let's see, is it going the right way there? And now in the fall, we're hitting a minimum and it's still above 400 ppm. And so there's no going back, as you say. I mean, it's in the lives of anyone living, you, me, anyone born today, it's highly unlikely that the carbon dioxide levels are going to get below 350 parts per million, below 400 parts per million again. In fact, it's likely to continue rising. I mean, it's and so tell me, D.R., what are the implications of over 400 ppm in the atmosphere?
Well, frankly, death. Let's be honest about it. And connected to that, there is a new study being issued by Robert Watson and some other former members of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a study that says that, according to the Washington Post, quote, the chance of holding warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels has almost certainly been missed, and we could be on an irrevocable path to 2 degrees. And obviously, you know, inevitably you may have it going far past 400.
It's cumulative. Right. Just keep going.
It just seems to be sort of not to be gloomy about it, but a death spiral. And we'll be seeing several spirals in terms of hurricanes and more extreme weather events as a result of all this.
Well, so that there's a lot of numbers that get bounced around. So we should carefully set these things up. Most people have heard that the safe, quote-unquote, safe limit for temperature rise over the average temperature when George Washington was stomping around, the safe limit of a temperature rise from then is 2 degrees Celsius. Now, it turns out that a lot of people have begun to question whether or not a 2-degree increase in the temperature, whether that was really a safe limit. So in the Paris Accords this past December, right, the big Paris Agreement, there is a explicit recognition of the idea that the average of 1.5 degrees over the average is actually a better target, a more sane target. And just keep in mind, when we say 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees sounds like nothing, but this is a global average of temperature, right, which encompasses all the extremes on the entire planet. So a 2-degree rise, in fact, leads to much more extreme weather locally, right?
Exactly. So, imagine your body temperature going from 98.6 degrees to 100 degrees.
Yeah, well,
you have a good idea of what's going on.
And so the idea that the 350 parts per million is, in fact, connected to the 2-degree target, which these are all chosen by people, right? It's because it's a judgment call, right? The scientists make their estimates, but they say, okay, politically we think 2 degrees because we think we can keep the CO2 under 400 parts per million. But of course, when you say 2-degree rise, that means all the Pacific islands are gone, the coral reefs are gone, and that's considered a safe world, right? So these numbers are real. They're threatening, and as we say, we've crossed this milestone, we need to start thinking about ways to reduce, not just reduce the increase, but to actually decrease the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. Of course, that goes into all kinds of stuff like the Savory Institute, organic farming, recapturing stuff from the air. I mean, there's lots of things there, but it's
not burning the carbon in the first place.
Well, so now that's an interesting segue, my friend here. Bill McKibben wrote, so just again, as context, we have these reports. The Earth has finally gone over 400 ppm for, let's say, the next 500 years, right? Unless we do something real about it. The scientists say we've pretty much blown our chance to stay at 1.5 degrees, and we're headed for a 2-degree, which is pretty ugly. Our friend Bill McKibben, in the middle of that, drops an article from the New Republic. And I'll let you summarize it, and then I'll summarize what you said. But what did Bill McKibben... Now, Bill, before I let you go, DR, Bill McKibben, of course, has written the Do the Math article. He was the initial, he popularized the Keystone XL thing. He has basically led the divestment movement. He has been a mover and shaker. And so this last article that just came out this past week, what is the point of the article, DR?
Well, McKibben notes, quote, if our goal is to keep the Earth's temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, the upper limit identified by the nations of the world, how much more new drilling and digging can we do? Here's the answer, zero. That's right. If we're serious about preventing catastrophic warming, the new study shows we can't, by Oil Change International, I believe it is the study he's making reference to, we can't dig any new coal mines, drill any new fields, build any more pipelines, not a single one, unquote. So in other words, you would have to have a sort of radical decarbonization of the worldwide economy in order to avoid the worst impacts of human-caused climate change.
Well, right. So precisely. So what I think McKibben is saying is the following thing. He is recognizing sort of an agreed-upon idea that there is a budget of, there is an allowable total tonnage of carbon dioxide that can be emitted into the atmosphere before things just go totally off the rails, okay? And he says that number is something like 800 additional gigatons of carbon can be emitted into the atmosphere over the next 30 or 40 years. And that's all there is. That's the maximum you can do. If you go beyond that, you're really in trouble. He makes the point that the identified carbon reserves that are already being held by the likes of Exxon and whatnot, even if we don't discover anything new, those reserves are already at 932 gigatons, right? So we've already identified enough coal to more than saturate the planet without discovering anything new. He goes on further to say that if you think you want to stay within the 1.5 degree temperature rise, right, the cooler world, then the budget of carbon, the amount of carbon that you can emit over the next 30 to 50 years is only something like 340 gigatons.
353
gigatons. And then, and this is all very clear in the article, I'm trying to find the exact number here as we, as I speak. Right, so we can emit 353 gigatons, but, and here's the kicker, is that the fossil fuels that have already been exploited, not just identified and that we know there might be some, you know, oil underneath the Arctic somewhere, the things that we're already drilling, if we exploit those, we have already gone over the budget for the 1.5 degree limit. So yes. To your point, I mean, if you want to stay within the carbon budget, there's no point in discovering any new oil. Right. There's no point in even drilling for any new oil because the oil we already have is more than enough to do the damage that's needed to be done, that well, not needed to be done, but the damage that would mess everything up. Right. So
and it's amazing how people have in their response to sort of underplayed what McKibben is actually saying. McKibben is actually saying you literally have to, in effect, shut down the international fossil fuel industry. Yeah. I think a lot of people are sort of scared of the import of what he's saying in that respect, and they don't want to say it as specifically as he, in fact, says it.
Right. So next time you see the ExxonMobil ad with the cheery young scientists telling you how they're working to, you know, save the world and discover new oil resources,
throw something at the screen.
Throw your shoe at the screen, because but it's also, this also syncs up with the whole question of whether or not the oil companies are an investment risk, because they have all these stranded assets. They've sunk all this money into discovering these oil fields they haven't even exploited yet that we can't touch. Plus, they want to spend more money to discover new things. And it's just, I mean, it's folly, because we're never going to be able to extract them as a civilization, right? Maybe maybe we extract them, we all die, and then you know, Exxon goes out of business. But if you want to have a working civilization, you can't dig all that stuff up. So it puts the Exxon Corporation in a funny place. Exxon being sort of the proxy for all of the oil industry, puts them in a bad place, because their future is limited. Just, you can't drill anymore. You can't find any new coal because you don't need it.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh, I'm getting all worked up, dear. I better take a cold shower here. But I mean, McKibben's article, I think, will be quite influential. Right? It just says you got to stop now, right? Cold turkey. At least it's not that you can't burn the fossil fuel that you have identified and are in the process of extracting. It's just that you cannot dig any new wells, right?
Exactly.
So tell me, DR, what, given all of that kind of stuff, you were telling me before how the Conservation Law Foundation has taken out another attempt to rein in Exxon's, what shall we say, profligate greed. What's the CLF done this time?
Exactly. They filed a very interesting lawsuit pertaining to a storage facility that's located in Everett, Massachusetts, which is leaking toxic pollutants.
So Everett is a town just north of Boston. It's part of like a suburb of Boston just north up near Logan Airport, right?
Exactly. According to the CLF's lawsuit, this storage facility has been leaking toxic pollutants into the water for years, and the company has failed to sort of secure the facility against the risk of rising sea levels, ironically enough, caused by Exxon's products, and that they're thus violating the Clean Water Act as a result. So this could, according to Think Progress and other organizations covering this, there's an expectation that this could be the first of several lawsuits basically built around the Exxon news stories from last year, basically saying that ExxonMobil not only knew what the risks were of its products, but they weren't even securing their own facilities from the risks caused by its own products.
Right. So the CLF is saying that the sea level is going to rise. It's going to make this leaky problem worse. Exxon hasn't done anything about it, and they are the cause, and they knew it all along. And so therefore they should. Interesting.
And with regard to the water pollution, remember what they're saying in the Dakota Access protests: water is life.
Yes, absolutely. Well, that's what they're saying in Flint, Michigan. That's what I mean. I picked up I was in a bookstore the other day, and I did not buy the book, but it was a description of how it was called the Water Wars, and how the limited amount of fresh water in the world in this corporate age, in an age of climate change, is going to be way more valuable than oil in the not too distant future.
Mm-hmm.
Goodness. Well, there was a report that Massachusetts has a report extolling Massachusetts as a climate leader. Right, right mm-hmm. up there with California. I mean, Massachusetts likes to think of itself in the same sort of impact as California. I think California is a pretty big place with a lot of consequence. But what was the report about Massachusetts this week?
It's a great story in Climate Wire, basically discussing the recently passed so-called omnibus energy bill and the recent court rulings from the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court, and basically saying that between the expansion of carbon-free electricity and these various, you know, legislative and judicial efforts to sort of reduce carbon pollution, Massachusetts is now competing with California as sort of America's clean energy capital, which, again, you know, it's you only want to pat yourself on the back so much because there's so much more that can be done.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, the article that I saw was saying that in addition to all those good things that we have talked about in the past, Massachusetts, I guess, has a rather large install base infrastructure of energy storage systems,
mm-hmm.
right, which is sort of the key to utilizing the renewable energy, right, to having these mm-hmm. these massive, essentially big batteries that absorb the energy from the windmill and then can send it out when it's needed on demand. And that's another reason that Massachusetts is sort of in the forefront, because we're developing this economy and this business. And of course, there's all the happy talk about, you know, the entrepreneurs in the financial sector and the universities and blah, 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 which is all true and good. But it's nice to know that Massachusetts is leading, and not to be chauvinistic about it. I mean, I hope that the other states can take advantage and follow the lead, do the same kind of thing, right?
Certainly, certainly.
Massachusetts. I sing the state song, but I don't know it. Do you know the state anthem of Massachusetts, dear? Probably not. All right. Well, anyway, DR, I'm going to tell everyone that they can listen to most of what we talked about at the blog. It's massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find the show on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher or iTunes. TuneIn Radio. You can find us on iTunes. And so we're going to close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.